Just this week, I got an email from someone who wrote a check that was cashed by someone who wasn't the recipient. Her bank basically left her to fight it out with the other bank herself. It's just so annoying. Sometimes consumers need help. Whether it's the banks going up against door-to-door salespeople, fighting back against telecom overbilling, consumers can really benefit from someone who has their back. For many, many of her readers over the years, Ellen Roseman has been that person, writing for the Toronto Star. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
You're kind of a legend. I said to my producer, Ellen Roseman's kind of a legend, in part because of your decades of service and in part because of the influence that you have. I want to start by asking you, though, how you got into the business side of the business beat, because you started out in women's wear, covering women's wear for Style magazine.
That was the only job I could get. The real influence for me, I didn't go to journalism school. I went to McGill and I worked on the McGill Daily for 3 years in the days when it was a daily Monday to Friday.
Wow.
And it was the late 60s. I'm dating myself, but we were so activist. We got kicked out for a while because we accused a McGill engineering professor of helping with the Vietnam War with his soil research. Student council got rid of us, and then we got reinstated again. So it was all about activism. And when I was looking for a job, I didn't have any journalism experience. So I got into the business side of things, and they asked me who was my big influence. I said, Ralph Nader. You know, that was the height of his fame. And then it was Beryl Plumtree, who was Canadian, who was appointed by Pierre Trudeau to study food prices in the days when inflation was 18 to 20%. And she came from the Consumers Association, and she was pretty tough. And I really admired her. And then Phil Edmonston from the Lemonade Card Guides. And
So the outlier was Style magazine. The outlier wasn't business. You've been doing this for a long time.
But way back when, I freelanced an article for Chatelaine magazine. It was called When Women Won the Fashion Revolution. This was in like 69 or 70.
Yeah.
Because they were wearing miniskirts, and everybody loved the miniskirts, but the fashion industry couldn't allow that to continue. So they brought out something called the maxi skirt, which was like almost down to your ankles. And everyone said, forget it, I'm not wearing that. And so maxi skirts flopped. And then soon after that, pants came in, and women could wear pants in the office, which was huge.
It's amazing historical context, right? Because we simply don't appreciate how far we have come. And so me as a guy, but for everybody, how far we have come in the generations or the decades that have passed. You were at the Globe and Mail for a long time. How did you get the consumer beat? Like where did that come from? Is that burning passion that you had back from Ralph Nader is my idol?
Yes, and also after the Women's Wear Daily, or the Style magazine, I was in the same building as the Financial Post. So I started freelancing for them. And I wrote about retailing and then more into consumer issues. So that's when I really got the feel for it. And in those days, the consumer movement was pretty strong and they got a lot of government money. So the Consumers Association would have annual meetings. They'd have like 300 or 400 people. They had a magazine. They did testing. It was really the heyday. And the federal government was giving them a great deal of money. And the provincial governments were starting as well. And so from the Financial Post, I went to the Toronto Star because I met the guy who was writing for the Toronto Star on consumer issues, and he was leaving for the Globe. So I went to the Star right away, and I said, I want his job. And they said, but you don't have any daily experience. I gave them my two full scrapbooks of articles, clippings, and they read it, and they said, okay, we'll hire you. And then funny thing was, a year after I was at the Toronto Star first for a year. Then I went to the Globe for 20 years. And then I went back to the Toronto Star. So I've been back and forth a lot. And I followed the same fellow who left the Star for the Globe. And then he left the Globe. He retired. I think he had enough money.
How do you see your role as a consumer advocate? Because you're not a traditional journalist in that you don't, you know, just sit there and just cover bank earnings and write those kinds of reports. You advocate for consumers.
Yes, it's changed a lot. At the beginning, I was writing a lot more about organized consumer groups, but they kind of fell apart. The Consumers Association had a lot of middle-class housewives who were at home with the kids, and they got very well-versed in insurance and baby seats and all that kind of thing. But then all of a sudden, women are in the workforce. Nobody had time for volunteer jobs. So the real game changer for me was the coming of email and the internet, because I'd write a story about how Enbridge was having a big problem. Their billing wasn't correct. There were a lot of people. I'd start with like one person and describe his story. I always feel that people relate to people really well. But then like I get emails from all kinds of other people saying, I have that exact same story. I thought I was reading my own story. Can you help me too? So email made it really simple. The Star, years ago before I got there, had something called Star Probe, which was an organized kind of... But what they did was they sent letters in the mail, and they waited for letters to come back in the mail. And at their peak, they had 7 people working there.
Wow.
And then they killed it in the 90s because it was too expensive. And then I started at the Star in 97, and I was business editor for 2 years. And then I went back to being a columnist. And I found that with email, it was so easy just to flip, you know, forward emails back and forth.
Yeah.
And that's when I started getting to know all the people that helped me out. And now when I send them emails, they're often, I'm sending them at 11 p.m. and they're responding at 11:30 p.m. It's quite different.
How do you determine what to tackle? You certainly could never tackle all of the complaints that you receive. I can't even imagine. How do you make the call?
I stick to larger companies. I want policy issues, customer service issues. The larger companies, those with familiar names, they have a brand to protect, so I have more traction with them. I'm not going to go after the little guy who goes door to door and paves your driveway and then sticks you with the bill. You've paid him all up front. The TV people love that because they can run after him and they can interview him. But I feel that that's not my role. So the bigger companies I found, there's plenty of issues. You know, we have the banks, we have the telecom, we have the large retailers. There are so many issues. I never run out of material, and I've been doing this 20 years now.
You say that oftentimes people respond with you quite quickly. What's your process? How do you go about fighting a complaint on someone's behalf or developing the piece that you're in that will end up in the paper?
It starts usually with one person writing to me about something. I think of them as my kind of mystery shoppers,
right?
Because they're out there in the field. They know what's going on. And one person will write to me about something. So if it's one of my, I don't know, I've got about 20 or 40 different companies that I follow closely and I know all the people and who to send it to. So I'll send the one, and then it's up to them to decide what to do with it. And sometimes they respond to me. Sometimes they just respond directly to the person. But if it's just a one-time occasion, I won't write about it. I wait until there's a critical mass of at least 5 or 6 different complaints. And then I'll go back to the company and say, look, there seems to be some kind of systemic issue here. That's what I'm always looking for. How do you respond to this? And a good example is my column today where I was writing about these phones that were sold by Google Play in Canada and manufactured by LG, and they're called the Nexus phones. And at first they were great, but sometime in the second year after the warranty's up, they went into something called boot loop, which is just an endless cycle of trying to restart and not being able to restart, booting again and again, and finally just the battery dies and then the phone becomes a brick. So they were helping some people under the warranty. It turned out there was a class action in the U.S., and that's often the case that LG actually settled in the U.S. And they kind of informally said to people, we're going to fix it for free under an extended 24-month warranty. But a bunch of people found that when they went to Google or LG, they were told the a serial number of your phone or the IME number showed it was from the U.S.
Like an incredible level of detail you have to get into these sorts of things. What advice do you have for consumers in fighting their own fight? They don't have your reputation. They don't have the direct email of the, you know, the public affairs person at these big companies. What advice do you have for them?
I'd say start by writing an email or calling. But if you call, make sure to put down all the relevant information about who you're speaking to and tape it. You know, it's not against the law to tape, and you don't even have to ask. Just do it, because they're always taping your call. And when you need their tape, you can't find it. So you don't get anywhere. Try and escalate it, get to the next level of the company. Sometimes they have that information on the internet about the different steps. But then when you get really frustrated, use social media. Twitter is often very good. Some companies ignore it, but other companies take it seriously. Go to the Facebook page of the company. They can delete you, and they often do, but make yourself a big pain in the neck and try and make sure that your complaint is justified, that you have some kind of expert testimony or clippings or photos or something to document it.
Do you have to manage your own emotions on this? Because I can imagine I could see myself getting very angry on behalf of the letter writers. And I don't know. Like, do you ever take it personally?
Sometimes, but after I've been doing this for a long time, I try and, you know, keep an even keel. I feel sorry for people, for sure. And I don't try call them anymore, partly because calls take a long time, but also sometimes they cry on the phone.
Oh.
That's hard. So, you know, I'll take their emails and I keep trying to encourage them. You know, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And sometimes it doesn't happen. But sometimes I'm reluctant to stop even when the company says no. I keep looking for other ways to get around it. And sometimes I'll manage to do that. But I have to be optimistic, even though I think that companies today get away with murder. And what bothers me is that they treat the media people like me with kid gloves. They're really, really nice. And they try as much as they can to give the customer the benefit of the doubt. But without me, they just grind them down and tell them, no, we can't allow it. Like Google would say, you've got a U.S. phone, even though it was sold in Canada, we can't touch it. And all these terms and conditions often written in tiny, tiny print. And so I have to keep saying, you know, if I get to the right person in the company, they're going to read this and they're going to say, poor person. But on the other hand, they're also going to say, how's this going to look in print? This isn't going to look so good.
Right. Thank you very much, Ellen. Appreciate you being here. Ellen Roseman is the consumer advocate for the Toronto Star.